And we want them out. I'll be talking today about, A Tale of Two Dogs and Other Modeling Adventures. Maybe a little bit sort of a different flavor of talk than most of the other ones we've heard. And actually, Leon Glass sort of kind of preceded me yesterday saying, nobody's been talking about ionic models. Well, here we go. Penny, of course, talked a bit yesterday. I'll be talking today a little bit about basically the fact that there's been this sort of explosion of models. And for lack of a better source, I went to CellML, which I don't really consider authoritative in any way. This is no endorsement of them, but just a convenient place to find some listing of models. They list about 37 total models. And this is, if you look at the time in which they were created, starting from around the 60s and around to 2004, which is as late as they went, you'll see that about a third of the models have been developed in about the most three recent years, and two-thirds of them in like the last 10 or so. So there's just been this explosion of models, and what do we do with all these models? We're now to the point where there are multiple models for the same species and region, so several canine ventricular models or human ventricular models or human atrial models, which are the ones I'll be focusing on. But what do we do with these models? One of the things that we would like to hope is that these models would give us some of the same answers when we ask them the same questions. So that's what I'll be doing a little bit today, is just sort of trying to characterize some of these models that are for the same species and region in various ways. So looking at APD and CV restitution, properties like DVDT max, alternance, what's the range, where do you get 2-to-1 block, what's the onset, those sorts of things. Memory, and then in 2D, what do their spiral waves do initiated in these models? Do they break up? Are they stable? And do these models agree? So, and we'll also try to compare these with experiments where we have experimental data. And there'll be a few interesting issues along the way that will just sort of pop up. And this will, as you can no doubt imagine, lead to some sort of larger philosophical questions that we sort of started talking about yesterday about the uses of models. Because I don't think it will come as a surprise to you that these models don't always agree. And that's what we'll see today in some detail. So I'll be talking about, as I mentioned before, a couple of canine ventricular models, a few human ventricular models, and a few human atrial models, and then we'll sort of summarize and discuss. I should mention that this is the first time I've given all of this talk in one talk, so this is like the director's cut version, so I'm going to try to speed through this so we're not here for hours and hours. But hopefully it will be informative and somewhat entertaining as well. So first we'll talk about canine ventricular models, which we cleverly thought would be nicely summarized by A Tale of Two Dogs. So these are two different ionic models of canine ventricular myocytes that were both developed in the last 5 years. The first is the Fox et al. Model from the Cornell group. It has 13 variables, 13 transmembrane currents. Intracellular calcium handling has just a single compartment, SR, and it doesn't track any of the other intracellular concentrations other than calcium.
So can you include the calcium?
Yeah. Both the SR and the intracellular. And the Hundruti model in 2004 has almost double it, well, more than double, 30 variables, just 14 transmembrane currents. It has more complicated calcium handling with a two-compartment SR, subspace calcium, and phosphorylation. It also tracks intracellular sodium, potassium, and chloride concentrations. So just a little bit of flavor of the model. What do they look like? Well, these are action potentials at fairly long cycle lengths. They're kind of similar, kind of not. The Fox model is the one in red. It has a larger amplitude, but a smaller. The Fox model has a lower resting membrane potential and a larger peak voltage. So overall, it's a larger amplitude as well. The Hundruti model has a more pronounced notch and it's a longer action potential.
One model that you put certain variables in, another, I don't know, what's the relationship between these? So all parameters which are included in the first, they are in the second, or it's quite different structure. So
it's fairly
simple extension, or it's
well, in this case, one of the reasons why there are more variables in the 100 is that it tracks more intracellular ion concentrations and has more complicated calcium handling. So a lot of the extra variables are for that. It also has some extra transmembrane currents that have extra gates that go along with that. To a large extent, though, the currents, I mean, to the extent that they have the same currents, those currents usually have the same number of gating variables close to it associated with each other.
The models agree, like if they have sodium channel, they have the same sodium channel, same gate, same kinetics.
These are some of the different, the most important currents, at least in these. And sometimes they're kind of similar, and sometimes they're not similar. So a lot of these, this may just be a scaling issue for some of these potassium currents. But the calcium currents look pretty different. I mean, the peaks, the sort of second peak in the Hundruti model that isn't in the Fox model. And sodium-calcium exchanger looks pretty different, a lot of sign changes. The potassium mostly look like a kind of rescaling of each other. We're going to focus a little bit more on, this is another thing that happens along the way. There's a proposed mechanism to suppress alternans which occur in the Fox et al. Model. That's by increasing the conductance of IKR by a factor of 2. And it doesn't change the action potential much. It just repolarizes a little bit faster, but that does turn out to suppress alternans. But there's another interesting story along with that we'll get to in a minute. Just wanted to introduce that. So if we look at what happens just if we want to measure restitution curves, so we're going to look at S1, S2 curves as well as a dynamic restitution curve. In the Fox et al. Model, as we decrease the S1 cycle length, this sort of the curves also just shift downward in a fairly orderly way, and the dynamic curve cuts across all of them. That's a slope one line. So if we want to have some measure of memory, one way we can look at that is the difference in these S1, S2 curves. And at long cycle lengths, there's about 25 milliseconds of difference in the APD. So that's probably not quite as much as you see in experiments. Well, we'll see in a minute that it isn't. But at least it's sort of in the right direction. It's sort of characterized in the same way. And alternans occurs for DI is less than about 70 milliseconds. In the Hundruti model, here we start with a 1,000, an S1 cycle length of 1,000 milliseconds. And initially, these curves start to go down as they did in the Fox model. But then they start to go up as you can further decrease the S1 cycle length. And it's just in a fairly unusual way. So the dynamic curve kind of cuts through those as well. So in slope one line. So it's really difficult to try to characterize. There's clearly some sort of memory. These curves are all different, but it's a pretty complicated story, and I'm not sure what to make of it. We'll see that that's not what we see experimentally, too. And alternans only occur at the very, very shortest DIs. This model doesn't alternate quite to the same extent. In tissue, you see the same thing, basically, for the Fox et al. Model if you measure in a 1D table. So as you decrease the S1 cycle length, it looks pretty much the same in the dynamic classes. This is the dynamic for a single cell, so they agree pretty well. There's not too many changes that occur in tissue. Again, the memory is still about 25 milliseconds at long DIs, but again, just this difference in the APD obtained for different S1 cycle length. Alternans for DI is less than around 60 milliseconds, a DI min of around 25. A DVD max of about 271 volts per second. In the Hundruti model, we again see this sort of complicated memory structure, but we see something else interesting as well. This is our dynamic curve in 1D. This is what we obtained in a single cell. So this is a large difference that we need to explain, and we will in the next slide. Just in these differences? It's really difficult to characterize. There are a lot of equations. I haven't tried to work that out in any detail. You know how it is. You mess around with one current and everything else goes haywire. So just to try to if you decrease one to see what that does, something else changes. So it's really hard to characterize. I haven't done that.
This is one of the first models where one of these phosphorylation proteins
incorporated into the activity.
How many do you might you give when you measure 30?
Oh, a pretty long time. I think these are 30 seconds. That's usually what I do, 30 seconds worth of stimulation. So however many that is.
That they've all reached the full freedom by now?
Pretty much, usually. That's not the case in all models, but these definitely the case for the Fox. The 180, there's I think that it does. There's a little bit of a variant that I'll tell you about in a minute that doesn't. But so anyway, it's fairly similar. DI is a little bit, alternance occurs a little bit, smaller DIs here. DI min is a little larger, so there's a smaller alternance range. And DVDT max is a bit slower. So that doesn't really affect the conduction velocity. So again, to sort of summarize, if we look at this sort of rate adaptation, so looking at the function of cycle length where you can see the alternance, that's the Fox et al. Model, and this is if you, in a single cell, and this is with that increase in IKR conductance. So you see there's no alternans in that case. And the Hund-Rudy model, there's a little tiny bit of alternans in there, but not very much. And again, looking at these restitution curves, first for a single cell, and then in tissue. So, oh, well, this is some alternate figures. oh, the reason why I put this, yeah, is to show that in, this is part of the story for the Fox et al. Model. So there's no alternans when you increase the IKR conductance in a single cell, but in tissue, which I hope you can see over here, you get alternans again. So you recover it in 1D. So just because you suppress it in a single cell doesn't mean it's not going to come back and play a role in tissue, because it clearly does here. So this is without, I mean, with the normal IKR conductance, and this is increased IKR conductance, then you get alternans in both of them. So that's a fairly interesting thing to have occurred. I mean, it was predicted in more phenomenological models, but here it is in an ionic model occurring. So again, here's this big difference in the restitution curves between 0D and 1D for the Hund-Rudy model. So what is causing all of this? Well, it turns out in 1D, this was really fun to do because, you know, you program this in a single cell and everything looks fine, and then you put it in 1D and it's totally different, and you spend a day thinking, where is my error? Because that's the first thing that I would think of, is that there's a bug in the code to get that kind of a difference, but it's not the case at all. What happens is that in the Hund-Rudy model, the action potentials substantially change morphology in tissue. And to demonstrate this, I'm going to use a little one-dimensional cable with a fairly large stimulus region, and then I'm going to show you what the action potentials look at as it propagates from the stimulus region down the cable at 8 different sites. So you can see at these first few points, the red, green, and blue, in the stimulus region, you get this large action potential amplitude similar to what you get in a single cell. As you go down the cable, you completely lose that. Now, it's normal when you couple things in tissue that your amplitude is going to decrease a bit because of electrotonic current. But this is a pretty large change of about 40 millivolts. So this is a pretty substantial difference, and what happens is that the D gate for the L-type calcium current doesn't ever activate, so your L-type calcium current doesn't kick in. What happens is that it does end up kicking in a little bit later, so that prolongs the action potential duration as you move down the cable. So that's what happens in tissue, and here's what the L-type calcium current looks like. So you get this sort of normal L-type calcium current with a spike at the beginning, just in the stimulus region. And as you move down the cable, you get this sort of late L-type calcium current that, as far as I know, is not physiological.
Stimulus?
I'm sorry?
Stimulus?
It's just a current applied.
But for a certain length of time?
Yeah, a short length of time. A couple. It's either 2 or 1.5, something like that. Yeah.
Do you try actually the single cell if you go to reduce your stimulus just above the threshold? It's why it's way above, we can have that peak spike there, so up to 40.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. So where do you go just, you know, up the threshold, you may get this action taken as.
Yeah, it may not activate L-type calcium current in the single cell. I haven't tried that, but yeah, that could be the case. So. Yeah. So conduction velocity restitution for both of these models is pretty flat. So for both the original Fox model and with the IKR conductance increase, and for the 100, there's a little bit of shortening there, but it's over a very, very narrow range of DIs, and you see it mostly in a ring. So in 2D, oops, that wasn't supposed to show.
But when you compare those, they're the same coupling, the same...
Yeah, for the same diffusion. But they're pretty close in terms of the... I mean, the curves actually look pretty similar, too, because there's not much curvature to them. And they're about the same velocity, so 45 to 50 centimeters per second. In the Hund-Rudy model, well, in both of them, you get fairly stable spirals, usually. So this is a trajectory. It meanders a bit more than the Fox will. We'll start the Fox one. This Fox one has a little bit of transient breakup at the beginning. But yeah, I'm really curious because Guy last week was showing this sustained breakup, and I'm not sure if it was a consequence of having a smaller domain or perhaps not having enough spatial resolution. The Fox et al. Model requires a fairly high spatial resolution of at least like 125 microns or so to avoid some numerical artifacts. So there's a little tiny bit of transient breakup just because of the way that I started the spiral. But it settles down into, I think this is one of my favorite tip trajectories. It's kind of a tic-tac-toe pattern that sort of precesses. So it's very stable, at least in a large domain where it's not really interacting with the boundaries. And this is a comparison of the trajectories, and this is a 1 centimeter bar. So this has a little bit of a longer core length, about 4.5 centimeters, and this is around 3.5. But still pretty similar. The period is much shorter in the Fox model, about 120 milliseconds compared to about 170. Now, what's interesting, there are interesting variants for both of these. And when we changed the IKR conductance by a factor of 2 as before, well, we saw there was no alternans in a single cell. We got alternans back in 1D. And what happens in 2D? Well, it does affect the stability. You get a lot of breakup, basically a strong meander, and then tons of breakup. So this is another interesting part of the story. Just because you suppress alternans in a single cell doesn't mean that you'll get rid of it in tissue, and it doesn't mean that your stability is going to be, that you're going to have a stable spiral in 2D. In this case, the one that alternated in a single cell turned out to be stable in 2D, and the one that didn't alternate in a single cell was the one that's unstable. Another thing in the Hund-Rudy model, and this we probably need to just do more simulations. This is exactly the same simulation as before, except that the stimulus, the S2 stimulus, was applied 20 milliseconds earlier. And we get the same breakup. Well, it's sustained until it extinguishes all the activity. All we did was change the stimulus time. Everything else was the same, the duration, the S1, the size of the stimulus. So it's a little bit unclear. At this point, we need to do some further investigations to determine which is more common. And why this was different from the other. The period is a little bit smaller. That's about all we can say at this point. So to sort of summarize just these... of that one?
Yeah.
That was about 160. The previous was about 170.
I mean, what is the period if it's...
The average period. So the good news in comparing these models is that they both have similar CV restitution and a similar maximum conduction velocity. They both have a similar linear spiral trajectories and can be stable in 2D, a similar minimum DI. But we're still looking at two different beasts here. This is a tale of two dogs. They have different alternant cycle length ranges, onset cycle length, magnitudes of alternants, different values of DVDT max, different spiral periods. And both CV restitutions, although they're alike, are unrealistically flat. There's also these issues in the Hund-Rudy model with the L-type calcium not activating. So actually they've come out with some sort of changes to make to the model to try to get rid of that, so including increasing the sodium conductance and a couple of other things, which does get rid of that behavior in 1D. But now you're faced with one model to use when you're in a single cell, and a completely different model to use when you're in tissue. So, the spiral stability for the Hund-Rudy model depends on the initial conditions, which is not very nice.
The next slide, could you comment more on good news? The last line is good news. Who is DIV?
The minimum diastolic interval in the restitution curve before you get conduction block. So, that's it.
The two models have similar IK1.
Pretty similar.
So, input resistance of the cell would be similar in both?
I guess. I don't know.
Does it mean that you can have some stable spiral sometimes, or it's not the case? So,
well,
in the
Hund-Rudy model, we did two different simulations where all we changed was the timing of the second stimulus used to induce it with an S1, S2 protocol. And in one case, it was stable, perfectly stable, and in the other case, it broke up and eventually left the tissue. So we need to do more investigations to find out which is more characteristic of the model.
And also the reason, I mean, in some more simplified models, you can see that the stability depends on initiation, especially when you see, for example, when you do cyclics, facing a cyclics, you know that hysteresis between 2 to 1, 2 to 1, and 2 to 2. So there's one period for which you can have 2 to 2, but also you can have 1 to 1. So initiation, any initial condition where you can have that field is going to have, depend on if it's going to be 2 to 2 stable or 2 to 1.
So you mentioned the percent of both of the substitutions are flat. Have you looked at the JMH case to what's causing this? Why aren't they kicking in to
Not really. They basically use the same sodium as LRD, which is also pretty flat. So it goes up a little. That's kind of funny.
Are they closed?
I haven't looked in detail at what causes the flatness of the curve. I just know that it's the same in most other models because it's the same LRD.
Do they derive their currents from the same set of experimental papers?
No, not really. Maybe for some, but I know not for all. And we saw along the way here also some interesting phenomena with the Fox et al. Model. Just because you have alternans in 0D doesn't mean that you'll have an instability in 2D. Or an alternans in 1D as well doesn't mean that your spiral won't be stable in 2D. And increasing the conductance of IKR by a factor of 2 shows that just because you suppress alternans in a single cell doesn't mean that it won't come back in 1D, and it doesn't mean your spiral will be stable in 2D. And the Hund-Rudy model shows just that initial conditions are very important and they can influence the stability of the model.
The spiral actually is a very, I call it hypermeander. You can put a single spiral in the tissue, it's hypermeander. But when you put in 2, the situation changes. So when you put 2, they are generally break up.
When you have 2 spirals, you mean?
Yeah, you use a different initial condition. Maybe you initially have a 2-to-1 block, you test a 2-to-1 block initially. Mm-hmm. When you put 2 spirals there, it's like a big old egg. Then in that condition, the 2 spirals will cause breakup. But if you can only put 1 there, the 1 will stay stable.
But in the one that I did, each of them was just 1. And in the case of 2, of course, there can be interaction.
In the state that the spiral is hypermeandering, actually, it's in dynamically very unstable regime.
Well, but it can be stable too.
If the pattern is stable. But in the other sense, the system is a very unstable situation there. You put 2, if they interact, then. Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't put 2, but if you put 2, I'm sure there can be lots of interaction.
Is it possible there's multi-stability in the system? How in general are these models? Do they behave differently? Can you have multi-stable dynamics in the different spaces?
I don't think you typically do.
Not typically, but there are regions where you can have hysteresis between two states. So that's why, depending on the initial condition, you can be in one or the other one. And like Siling said, once you have two hypermeander spiral waves, there's so much interaction that
it's kind of between the normalization of the chassis.
So it's how you reach to that state, depending on initial conditions.
I'm wondering when the CD restitution is very flat, there's probably people in this room that have better experience than I do, but it just seems like when the CD restitution is flat, that's a very it's a very sensitive situation as to whether you get breakup or not. I mean, there are two effects that, go against each other. One is that if the restitution is flat, then the CBO restitution is flat, the wave doesn't slow down when it approaches the another wave, you know, it just crash right into it. So, potentially produces breakup from that point of view. On the other hand, in order to produce breakup, a lot of times you need to put a gradient in that 5-thought interval in space, and you can't get that unless you have some finite exposures to the CBO restitution. So when it's very close to being flat, I feel like that's a very sensitive situation. Maybe that's why you said some of these things depend on the conditions and being quite a bit between some corruptions.
I know that Condito, working when we first developed our model on the epicardial dog, another kind of dog, we had to work on this conductual velocity restitution, of course, for the border zone, because we had to be able to change it in order to reflect the remodeled cell. And I remember, because we'd done the experiments of recovery of DVDT with prematures, we needed to get action potentials that showed the recovery of DVDT with prematures, or a restitution curve. And we needed to work a lot on that particular aspect of the sodium channel and using the H and the J gates to get that. So that was one of the major things that we had to do with the cell model to get the CV restitution.
Yeah, I don't doubt it, because everyone uses the LRD, which is pretty flat just to begin with. So, I mean, most people start with it anyway. So, as a little bonus, we have a comparison with experiments, since, of course, I'm at Cornell and we do a lot of dog experiments there. So, this has been Flavio's debut as an experimentalist, doing lots of microelectrode recordings from dogs, both endocardial and epicardial, although we do more endocardial and we'll focus on that. So just some samples. So this is just sort of comparing the three cases. So the Fox et al. Model. This is this Hundredy, what I'm calling the HRT model, for lack of a better term. This is including their changes to use this in tissue without getting that L-type calcium issue. So that's the HRT model. And then what we get experimentally. So this is looking at sort of the bifurcation and alternates. So plotting cycle length on the bottom and APD on the side. Again, in tissue. So there's a very narrow region for both the Fox et al. Model and the 180 tissue model, just at these very small cycle lengths. I have a table on the next page that will summarize this too. In experiments, you see two differences right away here. First, it's a much larger range of cycle lengths that alternate. And second, the magnitude of that alternance is very different. In these cases, it grows as a sort of a, in this kind of a shape with a square root dependence. And here, it seems pretty linear. This growth, and I guess this goes back to Zhao Peng's talk a bit.
What is the tissue here for the experiment?
This is actually endocardial, because it alternates more than epicardial. Epicardial does nothing.
You have a totally different action potential in the endocardial.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you put the HRT model or the Fox model, have they been changed to be endocardial models, or are
no.
they still epicardial models?
No. The 100E is an epicardial. The Fox, they claim to be an M cell because it was based on a Winslow model of an M cell, but I don't think it's really long enough to be an M cell. So I think it's really more epicardial. I mean, I could compare it with epicardial. I'm just trying to be generous in terms of how I compare with the alternans, because in the epicardium we don't see alternans very often. So I'm actually being nice by comparing it with what we see in the endocardium in terms of the alternance magnitude. Dynamic.
How long do you spend to
long enough. or longer. It depended on the experiment. So, but generally it was a steady state. So and looking at also S1, S2 restitution curves, we find that this nice, sort of neat-looking S1, S2 restitution curve situation, where the curves just go down as S1 decreases, is what we see experimentally. These curves are also going down with S1. And this complicated thing that you see in the Hundredy model isn't what we see experimentally anyway, so, which is kind of nice, because this is a little bit messy. And it's certainly nice to know that the experiment actually it follows the neater model. So that's the, I have a summary of all this stuff in a table here too. So just comparing for the models where the alternance onset is. Alternance occurs at a little bit of a higher cycle length in tissue, and 2-to-1 block occurs at a much lower cycle length. So there's a much larger window in which alternance can occur, a much wider range of cycle length. But the average alternance magnitude is pretty small in tissue compared to in the models. Even the maximum is usually under 20 milliseconds, whereas in the models it's much, much bigger, again because of that different sort of bifurcation that you have. Yeah. Oh, well, in the experiments, it usually was like exactly one. So, I mean, it almost looked like you had one curve and then, boom, there was your slope one. It was just, I mean, a hair maybe above slope one. And it's sort of memory looking at this difference in the maximum APD depending on the S1 cycle length used in S1, S2 protocols. You got a much bigger sort of memory effect, almost 50 milliseconds, well, 45 anyway, in experiments, and it was much smaller in the tissue, although they agreed with each other in the models.
So
if you compare the models, the single cell, how do they compare there?
Oh, well, a little bit different because you have more of an alternance region in the Fox et al. Model. It's still a fairly small window in the 130 model. In the Fox et al., you actually have the alternance grows and then it comes back together at very short cycle lengths. But those don't propagate in 1D, so you don't see that behavior there. So and the memory is pretty similar. So this is also just showing one other feature that we see in the models when you have alternance. When you have these shapes, looking at the active potential morphology, if you overlay the long and the short, the long one is always higher than the short one at all. I mean, throughout the whole action potential in both of the models. Whereas experimentally, we see them crossing, which is just sort of an interesting feature that the models don't seem to capture. This is endocardial. I don't know. It's just a microelectrode recording, so.
No, I mean the Fox model. Like,
oh yeah, they have ITO because they're epi.
Oh, okay, so it's an epi model.
Or more epi. Fox, again, they claim to be M.
Well,
the epi doesn't alternate. So that's why I'm comparing it with the endo, is because the epi just doesn't alternate.
So,
I mean, if you compare it, I'm trying to be generous, but if I compared it with the epi, then the models would be even more wrong. So just to sort of summarize, trying to be nice to everyone here, the S1, S2 restitution curve shapes are much more similar to the experiments for the Fox model, whereas the alternance magnitude is a little bit smaller in the Hundrudi model, so that matches a little bit more closely with the experiment. Although they both really are kind of far off in terms of the alternance magnitude and the range over which you get it. And this other interesting fact that the alternance action potentials don't cross in the models if you overlay them, but they do in the experiment. So moving right along to human ventricular models. There are three main ones that have been published in the literature, and there's a fourth one that is as yet unpublished, coming from our lab. But there's the Priebe and Beukelmann, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. My apologies to the authors. It dates from 1998. It's an epicardial-only model with 17 variables, 10 transmembrane currents, and it uses LR2 calcium handling, so that's two compartments. The Santusher et al. From 2004 has descriptions for epi, endo, and M cells. It's also 17 variables, this time 12 transmembrane currents, and the calcium handling includes a single compartment, SR. This Iyer Mazari Winslow model from 2004 is epi only. It's 67 variables, and there's this tremendous jump because they use Markov descriptions for everything. Audience question, how many of these 67 variables do you think are devoted to ITO? Another guess?
30.
Closer, 20. Because there are 10 state models for both the KV4.3 and
KV1.4.
It's almost two-thirds of the model is ITO, and you sort of think it's just a But it's a lot of variables. 13 transmembrane currents, and they have, you know, reasonably complicated calcium modeling. There's also a sort of minimal model that we've been working on in our lab with Flavio and with Alfonso Bueno, a student who works with us in Spain. It has descriptions for epicardial, endocardial, and M cells, and it has sort of three summary kind of currents and four variables.
Why
do they use it?
Yeah.
You'd have to ask them. But, yeah, I mean, the Markov models are just a different sort of approach because you can see things change.
So you start one loop is enough. It is the evidence of small number of channels or something?
Not as far as I know.
They just use this Markov scheme.
Yeah.
But they use Markov space. Yeah, you just use the name Markov.
Instead of just open or not open.
But actually, it just says really as close, open in the equation, but then you still write the Gmelin differential equation for the three states. Not like the Hodgkin-Huxley, you have only activation and inactivation, which is a different type of model.
I'm sure you'll hear from Colleen next week when she describes her recent Markov. And the reason you get states is because some of the mutations of the sodium channel, the potassium channels, actually are at amino acids that will affect the state of conformation of the protein. So if you have any of that information from single channel, then you want to put that in the model to see if it has an effect to long QT, short QT. Whatever.
And what states?
Well, if you have a mutated sodium channel that has a time to first latency that's delayed, and you can put it into the transposons and measure it in an expression system, and you want to see what that's going to, what the effect will be on the action potential, you have to go all the way back up. You can't just predict what's going to happen.
The Hodgkin-Huxley type one, there's a big difference there. So for the sodium channel, you can separate inactivation and recovery, use the H and J gate, because the J is very slow. But for the N-type channel, there's a very difficult issue. We cannot really use the Hodgkin-Huxley because the inactivation time is roughly 100 milliseconds. But the recovery time is 50 milliseconds. So we cannot put in a slow gate for the
recovery.
But
there is a slow gate in the calcium channel.
Well,
it's just that we all don't measure it.
Well, yeah, that's a good real one. But there's fast one recovery. We cannot use a Hodgkin-Huxley gate to do that. Yeah. So that one we need. You really need a Markov model to separate the inactivation and the recovery. So basically, all the L-type channel using the Hodgkin-Huxley model will be wrong. The recovery is independent to the inactivation.
So but I still don't understand. I mean, so what's the difference between a Markov model and just having some rate equations?
I don't understand.
What's the difference?
Well, that's from the typical channel people, that you model the channel stochastic opening, at the beginning that you say the channel goes from close to open,
yeah,
and to another
state.
That would
be a stochastic model.
Yeah, for the single channel, it is a stochastic model.
Mm-hmm.
But the one you ensemble thousands of this, then we write the differential equation for these states.
But that's Hodgkin-Huxley.
No, that's
Hodgkin-Huxley.
Hodgkin-Huxley only activation, inactivation. That's the Hodgkin-Huxley. It's an independent two independent process. Close to open, and you have an inactivation. It's a two independent process. Markov model is dependent.
So you mean sequential? Is a sequential opening?
Yeah, sequential.
Yeah.
Well, that can be
both closed states.
Usually,
you can have two.
Whatever you can get in.
Sequential opening. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
CC.
Leon has
I have another answer, but I wanted to hear what the rest of your analysis. I'll give my answer.
Okay. What was the question? Is this still
the question
why using Markov? So Well, they measured all the channels they cloned human channels in oocytes for that study and measured all the channels from there. Anyway, so action potential shapes are different for all of these models, and these are sort of the abbreviations for them. So this is the Tantusher et al., the Krieg-Boichelman, this is the Iyer-Mazzari-Winslow, and this is the minimal one. So this has a sort of funny hump kind of shape, but I don't know. This is an experimental one, which this minimal model was based on, so it should look very similar. And the others, well, you know, you make up your own mind as to how closely you think they reproduce that sort of a shape. So these are just epicardial action potentials shown here. Oh, this is another difference between the models. You can imagine that the 67 variable model is going to take a lot longer to simulate, and it does. So this is actually unoptimized code. So maybe, well, it's fair because it's all doing everything sort of the same way. So to simulate 10 seconds in the Tantusher et al. Model, so this one takes around 4.1 seconds. In the Krieg-Boichelman, it's about twice that, 9.2. 17 minutes for the Iyer-Mazzari-Winslow model, because you have to take tiny time steps for these Markov states, because the transitions are very fast. So unless you do some clever tricks, which we do later, it takes a long, long time to simulate anything. This minimal model, 0.13 seconds to do 10 seconds of activity. In tissue, all of these models, sort of as we saw before with the canine models, they lose a little bit of amplitude on the upstroke because of the fact that you're coupled and you have electrotonic currents trying to pull you down. So, but they lose that amplitude to varying degrees. So, I mean, almost 20% shortening in this Krieg-Boichelman. Whereas in the minimal model, it's a very small reduction, which is closer to what you see experimentally. Which I should have somewhere. Do I have that here? I guess I don't. That must come up later. Restitution for these models, again using only the epicardial, is different. The dots are experimental data for human epicardial cells, and the minimal model was designed to reproduce that, so it goes through most of these points. The Tantusher et al. Is also pretty similar. These other two have pretty long action potentials, much longer than are seen experimentally. So that could be a bit of a problem. The black dots are experiments. So, and looking at transneural properties, only the Tantusher et al. And the minimal models give descriptions of endocardial and M cells. This is some. I'm sorry.
What kind of ventricles?
Human? Oh, I don't. These were mostly.
It's not so easy to get access to them.
I'm sorry.
It's not so easy to get access.
Yeah.
Germany.
And is it for the
are they sick or they're from accident?
I know for the one of the, well, I don't know if actually for all of these papers. I know for the Iyer-Mazzari-Winslow model, they cloned the channels and expressed them in oocytes and that sort of. For these recordings, I'm really not sure. Do you remember, Flavio?
They were what? The drawing, I think it was, you know, the killing of the heart that was expanded and the associated cells in the issue.
But it was sick or not? It was like a valve issue? Or?
Yeah, something like that. They have for different cases.
This one, I think, these were explanted hearts, right?
Right.
Again, but some of them were for valve-related problems, and so the rest of the tissue was hopefully fairly healthy.
Some of the restitution curves are also worked in Germany. They do it on a human brain.
You can get them here. You can order up a human heart if you want one. No, I'm serious. You get on a list, and what you do is you get a heart that's ready for transplant. It's on its way to Colombia. Mm. But then they run some tests on them, and they
decide. It doesn't matter.
You can't use it for transplant, but they harvest it so it arrives, and you have to be there.
And just pick it up and use it for it.
Yeah.
So if you're in the right place at the right time.
Well, I mean, it's a, you know, it's not totally black market, but it's gray market. You only take one subway to your pickup spot. Joe. That's a joke. Okay. Go yet. Never mind. It's a new business.
So these studies show different shapes.
Tape
that,
that's true.
Yeah.
Huh?
You're being taped.
Good. Is there anything else you want me to say?
Only if it goes in here. So these are different, the shapes for epicardial, endocardial, and M cells, and the DVDT max that you get, which is larger in the M cells and about the same for epi and endo. This is from the minimal model. Again, this is basically designed to reproduce these shapes. They're pretty close to them, so they should look very similar, and they do.
But they,
that's Flavio and myself and our group.
Could you comment about the minimal model? That is how many thousand?
Oh, no. As I said, at the few slides ago, I put that it has three sort of summary kinds of currents. It's a phenomenological model and four variables.
Human model with four variables.
So, I mean, it depends on what you're interested in, but I mean, it reproduces tissue.
It's like tissue, right? It's not to study.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to use it for, you know, Colleen's studies of mutations. At least not directly, but it's useful to answer different questions. So, and it matches the DVDT maxes pretty closely with experimental values, and again has this larger DVDT max for M cells. It's an Tuscher et al. Model. You can also simulate all of these. There aren't as many differences, and it's a kind of a notchy endo.
Can Tuscher have any calcium?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of LRD-like. Yeah, it does. And here the DVDT maxes are pretty much all the same, so it doesn't capture the differences that you see experimentally. But you can get something, and it's a little bit longer in the M cell, maybe not as long as experiments. If you produce restitution curves, there is also some experimental data available again from these papers in the literature. So the dots are experimental data and the lines are what you get from the models. So in the minimal model, again, it's not surprising that it fits these curves because it was designed to do so, but it does capture those dynamics. The Tuscher et al. Model, it's pretty close for the epi. The endo is a bit higher than it has been measured experimentally, and the M cell, on the other hand, is a bit lower. Now, there's not that much M cell data, as you can see. There are just 2 points on these plots, but until we have more data, that's about the best we can do to try to fit that. Conduction velocity restitution. This is using a diffusion coefficient calculated for all the values from human cells, so the size and the resistivity, those sorts of values. So, and for this value, only the minimal model gets a conduction velocity that's as high as is seen experimentally, of about 70 centimeters per second. It also has a broader sort of a shape. The other models are all pretty flat. Well, the Tuscher has a little bit more restitution in it, a little bit of a change. But the Iyer, Mazzari, Winslow, and the Preble-Eagleman are pretty flat. So what happens in 2D? Well, here's where things get interesting. So in the Tuscher et al. Model, you have a pretty stable spiral wave. It has a pretty linear core, and it precesses a little bit around there.
What do you say size of human?
I forgot to look up the size. Do you remember the sizes of these? Do you remember the sizes?
It's
probably like 10.
Yeah,
10 centimeters or something like that. The Preble-Eagleman model it's sort of stable and sort of not stable. We kind of call it quasi-stable because it sort of blocks itself, but it doesn't actually break up. So there's a lot of sort of transient breakup, but it heals itself right away. So that's kind of a quasi-breakup. The Iyer, Mazzari, Winslow model loses all of its calcium and has very narrow action potentials. And it breaks up.
That's an ITO.
It may be just a really strong ITO. So.
Just keep in mind of ITO.
Promote causal pain.
Well, but if it brings you down too far, you won't get the outside calcium current. So it can, yeah, it can shorten the action potential quite a bit. So we've seen three models and three different kinds of behavior from them. The minimal model was pretty much designed to be a stable model in 2D.
You can get the other ones to get the other.
But this has a linear core and is fairly stable. But if you look at the average periods that you get, I mean, if the spiral is stable, then that will be the spiral period. In these other models, it's an average period over the tissue. You get different values there as well. So you get about 260 milliseconds for an all model, which is stable. About 305 for the pre-Boichelman. It has a pretty long action potential duration, and it likes these longer periods. The Iyer-Mazzari-Winslow, which breaks up a lot, it has kind of crazy behavior over a pretty broad spectrum. The dominant peak in here is 153 milliseconds, but it has another peak even shorter.
What does this mean? Does it spiral wind?
It's the average period, which...
Average period on the left graph may be 50 milliseconds.
It's basically like a histogram.
A histogram, not every histogram.
And in the minimal model, it's about 295 milliseconds. So this is, I think, pretty unphysiological. Has anyone seen periods like that in human CF? I think that it's usually, I think even in fibrillation, it's usually higher, like around 180. Sorry?
Fibrillation.
Well, yeah, it's pretty broad spectrum, but I still think it's, the average is a little bit low, at least for the people that we've talked to. So we can also construct a pseudo-ECG for the two models that have descriptions of endo and M cells along with the epi. So, and we simulate this in a little sort of a wedge preparation that we've divided into endo, epi, and M cells. And when we do this, well, these are the results we get for the minimal model and the Tentusher et al. Model. And here, the T wave is clearly produced by the fact that there are M cells that have different properties and a longer APD. Because in the Tentusher et al. Model, where that is greatly reduced, you see only a very tiny speck of a T wave, and it's much larger in the minimal model, but has a much larger variation, as the M cell is much longer than the endo and epi.
You produce ACG from the slice, not from the whole cut?
Yeah, in this case.
Stimulated?
Just the current. Yeah. So just to summarize, we've analyzed three previously existing and one new still in development model that hopefully will be coming out soon. Models of human ventricular action potentials in 0D, 1D, and 2D, and in a couple cases in 3D. These models all produce completely different behavior in 2D. So you have spiral waves that are stable, spirals that completely break up, and spirals that are in between with this stability. To promote our model, it can be simulated a lot faster, and it has more realistic. It's very close to the action potentials in literature, and as well as the ECG, in terms of getting a T wave. So that's nice to have. Moving along to human atria models, and we'll try to speed through this a little bit. So in this case, we have two human atrial cell models that actually came out in the same year. There's a Nygren et al. Model and the Kordmash et al. Model. The Nygren et al. Model has 29 variables, but in some cases we use 24 because of issues associated with concentrations and stability. So it becomes a little more stable if you clamp some of the concentrations. So we do that sometimes and sometimes not. We actually have a similar issue in the Kordmash et al. Model where there are 21 variables, but we actually, in all of these simulations, we just use 19 because the intracellular sodium and potassium just kind of drift linearly. It's a very small linear drift, and it doesn't appear to be physiological or to really affect anything, so we don't bother to simulate them. It seems to be what most people do anyway with that model. In this case, they both have 12 transmembrane currents. They're the same ones, and they have data from human data only for four currents, because that was all that was available. So they're actually, to the extent that data was available, they're based on the same data. For all of the other currents in the calcium handling, that was all done however they chose to do it, because human data wasn't available at that time, so they're doing the best that they could. The other thing that's interesting with the Nygren et al. Model, which I don't know of any other model that makes this assumption, But they choose to have everything be at rest. If you're pacing it at 1 second cycle length, then the concentrations will all behave themselves. If you pace faster, if you pace slower, if you stop pacing, the concentrations go haywire, which is a little bit strange because most of the time you sort of assume that in the models anyway, that homeostasis is achieved in the absence of pacing. But this is a different one.
Comment please more about homeostasis of 1 second. What do you want to say? Let me tell you what I understand, but it's definitely not what you wanted to say. I understand
okay.
that the power of ATP pumps adjusted in such a way that increasing 1 second concentration of intracellular potassium is the same. Is this what you wanted to say?
That is not what I wanted to say. I just mean that the ion concentrations don't drift off in all directions and never reach a steady state. It has nothing to do with ATP pumps. It's just if you pace this model at a 1 second rate, the ion concentrations will reach a steady state. In this case, so. If you turn it off, then they drift away and generally won't settle down. Yes.
I would say that just ATP pumps work more intensively than needed, they're not adjusted.
Good, okay. I don't know.
Well, just there's not one. What are some of the mechanisms that produce grief or not?
But, I mean, that's a little bit of a different issue than it is in this case, because that's even if you take the stimulus current into account. So, on a cellular level, you get so the CM is for the Korsmosh model, the NM is the Nigrin model with the full-blown 29 variables, and MF is Nigrin model with several of the ionic concentrations fixed to try to eventually come to some sort of a steady state, because otherwise you don't.
Is it supposed to be a right atrial cell or a left atrial cell?
I don't believe it was specified. So, well, it's 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So, the models are different right from the outset because the Korsmosh model assumes a spike in dome morphology. So they say that was what was more commonly seen in their lab. The Nigrin et al. Assume a triangular action potential at all cycle lengths. They say that's what they see in their lab. And it could be just a factor of regional heterogeneity because there certainly is plenty of it in the atrium. So there's a lot more rate adaptation in the Korsmosh model and very little in the Nigrin model, except actually in this resting memory potential that does drift up as you pace faster. And in fact, if you plot, what's plotted here, this is as a function of cycle length, the maximum and minimum voltages, so the resting memory potential and the peak of the upstroke for all of these models. Well, it starts out fairly constant, but as you pace faster, these change pretty dramatically. So the resting memory potential drifts up quite a bit, especially for the Nigrin model variation, but eventually for the Korsmosh as well. And the amplitude also decreases. So this makes it a little bit tricky to measure restitution because, and at least given we typically measure it in models. But usually we just use a fixed threshold, a fixed voltage threshold like this blue one, which does happen to be APD90 at a cycle length of 1 second. But if you do this, you sort of have a false minimum cycle length here because as soon as the resting memory potential goes above that threshold, you're no longer measuring anything, even though the cell can still respond. Now you can sort of get around that by sort of, you know, extrapolating and using negative DIs and such. It's probably much more comfortable and realistic to use a true APD90 so that threshold will change as a function of cycle length. So that's what we tend to do.
This triangle shape of the breaking the point in the edge, I think the APD restriction here is not a good one, but there's another one, ERP restriction.
Yeah, that's another alternative.
Mm-hmm. So that one is unique. It doesn't depend on the cutoff of the towards 90 degrees.
Yeah, that's true. So if, depending on how you measure the restitution curve, you'll get two very different things. So the solid line is what you get when you measure an APD90 that will vary So the threshold varies as a function of cycle length. If you just use a fixed voltage threshold of what APD90 was at a cycle length of 1 second, you get this very, very flat dotted line. I think this explains a lot of the different results. I remember seeing all kinds of different posters and such at conferences talking about the Nigrin model, and you'd see restitution curves all over the place. So often they were extremely flat, but at the same time, that's not really what the dynamics is. So I think it's a consequence of using that fixed voltage threshold for determining APD. So another problem for the Nigrin model is that these concentrations don't reach steady state in a lot of cases, even after several minutes, and especially the faster you pace. I pace this thing for like 10 minutes at a time, and it doesn't even appear to be leveling off. So it's a bit of a problem. So in this case, this is looking at a restitution curve you obtain. This is just a steady state protocol. So by pacing at every cycle length for 5 seconds, 10, 30, or 60, then you can just see the curves go down, 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 and there's no sign of them stopping. So rather arbitrarily, for the data that I'm presenting here, I'm using 30 seconds as a cutoff. And part of the reason for that is that if you do fix those extra concentrations to try to help it settle down, it does settle down by 30 seconds. So the 30 second and 60 second curves, you can't even tell a difference in this plot. So at least by fixing some of those concentrations, you can get something that does kind of reach a steady state. So I should probably speak through this with me a little late. So basically, restitution in single cells. There is a little bit of restitution, not a whole lot in the Korsmansch model. There is a little tiny bit of alternance for some really tiny cycle lengths, which is a little bit strange, but it doesn't really come into play most of the time. One of the interesting things in here is that not only is the memory effect small as measured by what happens to S1, S2 curves as you change the S1 cycle length, but it's actually inverted. All the curves I've seen experimentally have always decreased as you decrease S1. In this case, the curves actually increase. So the APD increases as you decrease the S1 cycle length. So a curve of this one on the bottom is an S1, S2, S1 cycle length of 1,000 milliseconds. And then you have to go up to reach the 500 and the 350 millisecond curves. I don't really know what that means, or if there's any experimental evidence that has ever shown something like that.
I've seen it only in rabbit.
Really? In rabbit atrium? Or okay. Yeah, and that has a pretty, at least the rabbit atrial curves I've seen have a pretty strong negative slope readings.
So that's going on there.
In the Nigrin model, whether or not you fix concentrations, there's no alternance. The curves are fairly flat, and then they shorten off at really short cycle lengths that won't even propagate in 1D. And the memory is also actually inverted for this when you fix the concentrations, but not when you don't. So in tissue, again, it's pretty much the same sort of thing, except you chop off a lot of the lower. There's really short responses that you get in a single cell that won't propagate in tissue. So, there's no alternance in the Korsmansch model. The memory is still inverted. The Nigrin model has a higher minimum DI than the Korsmansch model, so a little disagreement there. I'm not even going to really talk about this because there's not really time, but there have been some suggestions of trying to sort of make one model look like the other by changing conductances, and I'll show you a little bit of what happens in 2D when you do that. There's also some AF-induced modifications by changing some of the calcium and potassium currents and reducing them. It pretty much eliminates rate adaptation, and I'll show you what happens in 2D with that. Conduction velocity, fairly flat. Spiral waves are more interesting, so we'll go to them. So basically for the Korsmansch model, and when you change the Korsmansch model according to some suggestions to make it look more like the Nigrin model, basically, you get this sort of transient breakout. I'm sorry I don't have movies for this. I just didn't seem to have them on my laptop. But basically, as this propagates, you see little breaks that form, but they heal pretty quickly. So in most cases, whenever you get this break, it immediately starts to heal again. So most of the time it does. Not all the time, but most of the time, at least in a large enough domain where there's not so much interaction with the boundaries. And these are just some representative traces of tip trajectories. For the original Korsmansch, and then this modification to make it look a little more Nigrin-like. It doesn't look any more Nigrin-like. It looks almost exactly the same as the original one. So these are two different traces from the Korsmansch, and these are two from the modified. and they have basically the same properties.
When you're talking about this breaking and healing, you mean you don't see that in a ventricular model? Is it specific for an atrial?
Oh, well, not really, because the pre-Boichelman is pretty similar to that as well.
So this is not atrial?
No. It is specific to this model because you don't see that at all in the Nigrin model.
It tends to happen in models which have long AP and long wavelength. You have a long wavelength and a fast turn, but basically you can wait the interaction that breaks, but then the wavelength is so large that it just gets faster.
For the Nigrin model and also for the Korsmarsch model with sort of AF modifications, you get actually a beautiful gallery of spiral waves and trajectories. These are all stable. They don't break at all. This is what the spirals look like, and these are all the trajectories for these different modifications. So I think it's actually pretty amazing, and I'm still not entirely sure why, but this Nigrin model, despite the fact that the concentrations keep changing and don't settle down, it doesn't have much of an effect on the spiral wave because it is about the most stable thing you can imagine. It's very, very happy rotating around this very nice circular core. And this is over fairly long times. This is 60 seconds. Of rotation, so that's plenty of time for it to reach a steady state in all of these cases. And you do see some modifications over shorter time scales and over the first 10 or 20 seconds, but then they tend to settle down. So you see just a whole bunch of beautiful stable spiral waves. Yeah, this is kind of funny because what happens is, and you can see a little bit of it here, this core just sometimes sort of stays refractory, so it's and sometimes it propagates through there. It's a funny dynamic, and this trajectory is probably to some extent a consequence of the threshold I'm using to measure where the tip trajectory is, but if you measure it at different trajectories, you get a lot of spurious points where the spiral wave clearly isn't. It'll tell you there are multiple spirals, but there's just this one going around and around. So it's maybe a little bit of a consequence of the method. I'm not sure if a different method would be any better at it, but it has to do with just the dynamics in that core. So, and I think that comes out a little bit. And again, I'm sorry I don't have my movies with me, but all of those spiral waves you saw before, if you put them in 3D in a realistic atrial anatomy, and I was a little bit selective in putting them in about the flattest, easiest part of it to stick a spiral wave into in the left atrium. But nothing broke up. Of these variants of the Nigrin model, everything was stable, except that they may wander to a boundary and extinguish themselves. And actually four of these did, although two of them stayed on. This one did, and this one as well. So there's certainly, there was some increase in meander. This was this one that was a very stable little circle that does start meandering as a consequence of the curvature and complex geometry.
It cannot be the territory of one point. It should be the driving.
I'm sorry? Oh, this is a projection on the surface. It's a very, very thin tissue, on the order of 1 or 2 millimeters usually, so that you don't really see, and there's no fiber architecture, so you don't really see anything. Interesting.
What is the chance that you finally form a conduit or anything?
That you find a form of, sorry?
When you start a spiral wave, then how often do you think that you can this spiral will form an conduit?
Oh, okay. With this one, not so much, because these spiral waves are pretty tightly pinned. I've seen that in the Korsmarsch model, though. Not that often, but sometimes. But you can have it going across Bachmann's bundle and then down through an inferior posterior pathway.
Can you say a couple of words about this anatomy? Does it change?
It changes a little bit, but not much. It's on the order of 1 to 2, maybe 3 millimeters. So
it's a bit thicker in the middle than and thinner in the edges.
The thinnest points are probably, around blood vessels like the pulmonary veins and such, and it's probably thickest in the middle and in the septum.
Will this drift be something to do with the tension of the be shorter, and that's why they drift from the side?
I'm not sure if it's that, or because it could also be just curvature effects, because this is the curved domain as well. So I haven't looked.
More of the real and anatomical structures there. Are we seeing the left side?
Oh, you're right. This is the left side. Sorry, I should have had a picture for that.
The cell surface. Then.
This is the surface. So this is just pulmonary veins here, pulmonary veins there, left atrial appendage, kind of in between. This is the right atrial appendage there. and IBC, SVC. So.
This side.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, put that spot in. But I should have that one somewhere. And in the same geometry, the Korte-Monsch model, well, the AF version is pretty stable. It spirals around. For the Korte-Monsch model, the original one that had a lot of not exactly breakup, but semi-breakup in 2D, it does interact a lot more with the atrial geometry. So, for instance, here you can see that a separate spiral is formed in the right atrium, even though everything was initiated in the left atrium only. So, like here, you can see pretty clearly two spiral waves. But it doesn't really break up much more than that. It seems to be, at least over the 10 seconds that this simulation went over, there were two spiral waves that were pretty stable.
It's meant to be
anatomy. This is meant to be human. This is the Duke group, Harold and Enriquez, from 2000. It should self-terminate. Yeah. So I'm not sure that this might terminate over a longer time. I'm actually a little bit surprised that it persists over the 10 seconds. But the Nygren model definitely. Well, I guess actually it did go off the boundary in some cases. But if it doesn't extinguish on the boundary, it's very, very stable. This one is a lot more meandering and has much more of a chance to interact with things. Yeah, except for holding the potassium and sodium intracellular concentrations constant. So, to summarize and start wrapping things up, these human atrial models are extremely different. So it's, again, another story like the human ventricular models. They just do totally different things in tissue. There's different action potential shapes, different rate-dependent properties, a different stability of spiral waves. The AF-induced changes actually make them more similar. They both are sort of stable spiral waves at that point, but it basically just eliminates all the rate adaptation anyway, so they don't have really much of a choice of what to do at that point. And these supposed changes to just make simple changes in the magnitudes of the currents to try to make one model look more like the other. Well, that might work at one cycle length or so, but it doesn't really change the fundamental dynamics when you put these in 1D and 2D. So these models are different at a deep level. And it probably has...
You perceive it, what is AF-induced change?
Yeah, I didn't go into that a whole lot, but basically you can reduce some of the values of...
AF stands for?
Atrial fibrillation, I'm sorry.
It's remodeled.
Yeah.
The channels are remodeled in persistent atrial fibrillation.
Right,
thanks. Sorry about that. So where does this leave us? This is the...
Throw them out.
So this is the philosophical fun part here. Why do these different models of the same species in the same region, you know, meaning right atrium or left, you know, epicardial cells in the ventricles, why do they disagree? Well, the answer that we hope is, but we're not really confident about that. Maybe all of the models are accurate and they're just representing normal electrophysiological heterogeneity, or they have different conditions from the experiments, different ages, different sexes. We can't completely rule that out. maybe some of them are wrong and some of them are right. Some of them just got the physiology wrong and others got it right. Maybe they're all bad. They all have incorrect physiology. Maybe they're just not robust enough to be taken into new regimes and do something other than what they were designed to do. It may be that the physiology isn't known accurately enough over a wide enough range of physiological conditions to try to get these models to be robust enough over a wide range. So, should we trust models? Well, these are just things that we need to be aware of. I mean, these original models were validated for specific conditions. They may not be valid for your experiments. They may not be valid at fast rates. They could be temperature dependent. There could be different drugs in the system affecting extracellular concentrations. Could be different age, different sex, all kinds of different things. Most of these models also are not validated in tissue. There can be different effects. The fact that you can build a model one way doesn't mean you couldn't build it another way to do the same thing in a single cell. but that they might do different things in tissue, and they're not validated for that. Another thing, changing the model parameters doesn't ensure that the original validation holds. So if you start changing one thing, it affects other things as well. And if you go back, you may not reproduce the same graphs on which the model was originally based, which are the experimental values. Another caveat is that similar behavior doesn't imply a similar mechanism. Just because you get the same behavior, you get a stable spiral, doesn't mean that it's the same thing causing it to be stable. Parameter values often are not known to great accuracy, but in many cases the model can be extremely sensitive to these values, and that doesn't really get taken into effect either. It may be a very small change, but it can cause quite a large change in the dynamics. And sort of lastly here, the more complicated the model, the more parameters you have, the less predictable the behavior of it is. And with enough parameters, you can make a model do anything, anything at all, but it may not be doing it for the right reason. So that's definitely a reason to be concerned. But why we should use models anyway? One thing that can't be, I mean, now that we're starting to do experiments, something we appreciate all the more about models is that at least they're reproducible. they may be wrong, but they'll do that wrong thing over and over again. So you don't have to worry about effects of temperature and just
the preparation getting tired.
The most important thing is that it can really provide insights into a mechanism because you can control everything, because everything is reproducible. And it can be made as simple or complex as you need it to be to explain the phenomenon. And you can use that to make predictions, to test experimentally. this is just sort of the fun slide that what modelers don't want to hear and why. We're tired of hearing your model is too simple or it's just a model. Again, we're trying to look at mechanisms. And it's easiest to do by starting with a simple model and building up as needed. If you build this huge complicated model, you won't have any idea about what's producing the behavior that is of interest to you. You have to start stripping things away then, and then your model may not do what you wanted it to do anymore. So it's easier to start simple and build up. It's also the case that more complex doesn't necessarily mean that it's better or more realistic. And let's let the experiments test the prediction that the model makes. And again, we definitely don't want to hear, redo your results using model X. As we've seen, a lot of these models have a lot of problems. But the other thing is that the study may really be model independent. It's looking at a specific property that a range of models have. So it may apply to any model with similar properties. And model X may not have the property that you're wanting to study. There are a lot of models that don't accurately reproduce memory effects, as we've seen, that don't alternate. If you're doing an alternance study, you can't really use a model that doesn't alternate unless you vary all the parameters, in which case your model may not be valid anymore. So we're tired of hearing that. And another thing that should not be underestimated, model X may be impossible to code. Most of these papers have a lot of errors in the equations, as most of us know who've tried to ever code these things. And sometimes even with correspondence to the author, you don't get anywhere. So we definitely think that there should be a push for requiring, whenever you publish a model, a code that works, that reproduces the data in the paper. Because this is really a problem. And incidentally, not that I want to brag on them exactly, but the CellML site, it's a very useful resource, but they don't test their codes, and I found a lot of errors and things that they have there. So it's really easy to make an error, and it's something that needs to be addressed. This is one thing that modelers do need to hear. In a lot of cases, results, you really can't generalize beyond what you have. I mean, just like in experiments, your results are valid for what you did. And so many times you see statements that are just generalized way too much. You really need to qualify all the results that we get. It's valid for this model, these conditions. That's all you tested. That's all you know. So that's the end of the story. I don't know if it's a happy ending or not, but I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, Flavio Fenton on both theory and recently experiment. Very excited about that. Afonso Bueno, who's done a lot of the modeling work for the human ventricular minimal model. And, of course, Robert Gilmore and other members of his lab at Cornell. more modeling simulation adventures. You can go to our website. We have a wide range of models in single cells, 1D, 2D, and some interesting things there. So.